July 13th. Well, it is done. We have seen and survived combat somehow. Landon did not go as planned. I know of at least 9 men who drowned just getting to the beach, and one of them a pal who was in 2nd Platoon that got transferred to a different company, and they ended up going up the beach with the 26th. Goddamn fucking op fell to pieces. Dick McCafferty from Providence is the one who got killed. The poor bastard was a fisherman, too. I can't quite believe that he drowned. He is the first man I know to die personally, and although we all knew it would happen, I find myself not able to think about anything else. He has 2 brothers also, both in the Pacific and the Navy, and I do not know his parents' names, and I suppose the brass will notify the family, but I just feel sick about it. Dick was a good man, although I think you can probably only call him that now, as he cannot have been more than 19 or 20, and did not even have to shave, which we all had him over on. Funny bastard. I think even got our drill sergeant to like him somehow. I swear he just refused to do hospital corners, and finally Parks did up his bed for him, and then his bed was perfect, and the drill sergeant came early one morning and Dick was sleeping on the floor already in his full kit. I still cannot figure if it was him being that lazy, or if he got lucky on a chance at a joke, because Sergeant Banks could not believe his eyes. I cannot believe he is dead, and not even by a kraut bullet. Just tripped at the wrong time. His poor mother.
Wish me luck as you wave me goodbye. Cheerio, here I go on my way. Wish me luck as you wave me goodbye. With a tear, not a tear.
You are listening to The Night War, an audio companion. For more than 65 years, the Night War has taught us what it takes to fight a war, and what war takes from those who fight. We all remember reading The Night War for the first time, in excerpts from a ragged history textbook, alongside strings of dates and names. Some of us skipped ahead, bored and wondering when Captain America would show up. Others bookmarked the more salacious entries to giggle about with our friends. We live in a different world now, a world where the wars we fight, half a world away, in ones and zeros, or even over Manhattan, seem new and strange, and like nothing anyone ever learned about in school or could ever have imagined. But if there's one thing we can all learn from the journal written by a frightened, brave young man nearly 7 decades ago, it is this. The battlefield may change, but the fight remains the same. I'm Rose Cameron Barnes. Bucky Barnes was my great uncle. And together, we will explore the Night War like never before. It begins in 1943 on the beaches of Sicily. A and B Company stormed the beach with the 16th, and we were pinned down for hours by the Stukas. It was not at all like training, that is God's honest truth. I think all of us still have our blood up, as we were out there for 2 days. And though we should be sleeping, and I know several fellas are, I am not one of them. Somehow, everything is clearer and more terrible in combat. Krauts flew sortie after sortie, and that scream of the high-alt bombs is just as I remember Murrow describing on the radio from London. I feel as though these few acres of beach have been our own London for these 2 days. And not only can none of us hear it damn on account of the explosions, but I am sitting here, my back against the wall of a hangar which we are using to get some rack time, and my hand will just not stop shaking, and only stop shaking to write. Howe was terribly injured next to me. It was shrapnel that got him in the face and neck. There was more blood than I've ever seen, even after I got the sulfur powder on him. It all disappeared instantly. It was so loud with the shells that I screamed for the doc, but no one could hear, and so I gave Howe my morphine, and I got Walters to help me drag him, and Walters caught shrapnel, so it was down to me. Walters is all right, just got caught in the leg, and he's on a boat out of here. There was so much blood on me by the time I got him to the dock that he thought I was hit too, and I did not even hear him ask me if I was hurt until he slapped me in the face. Howe was just gurgling blood, but his face was white as hell, and his eyes were staring up at nothing. And when I looked at him, I froze because I thought for sure he was dead, and I'd just dragged a dead man 200 yards. But Howe is going to live, though his face is all tore up. His blood dried all over my blouse along with the salt, and it makes me think of Steve's test paper when he has the time and money for watercolors. Everything all blurring together, dried, rippled, stiff. Feels that way in my head, too. The pitch of the ducks and the smell of Baker and Yates is sick at the bottom of the boat, and the ocean making everything a splattered darker green, and the rumble of Shubrick's guns, and of course Howe's blood, and all the sand turned to mud and the earth getting torn up to hell pass after pass of the bombers. I am filthy too. No showers to get cleaned off in, and I have had enough ocean for now. Everything is going again in my head, all out of order, but it all comes back to Howe. The doc said he will make it. July 16th. Dream the landing again. I am finding that combat is so much more terrible than any of us imagined. I am shocked by the fear of it all. I think until now none of us even knew what fear could be. Somehow I found myself moving and firing my rifle and doing what was needed. But it felt throughout that I was somehow screaming away in my own head, "How can this be real? How is any of this happening?" And when we get to a safe position, or at least some cover, and the AK-AKs are firing, and the planes overhead are shrill, and everything is the loudest anything you ever heard. It takes every ounce of, to be honest, I don't even know it can be called courage, to get up and keep moving. It doesn't feel like I thought courage would feel. In the moment, it feels like beneath a bit of sand or driftwood is the safest place on Earth. And then you look over and see a fellow you don't know blown to bits so badly that there is nothing left of him I recognize as a man. And still I must keep moving. Tippett could not at first. We were beside some rocks, and for the moment, safe. And then the mortars started coming, and both of us, along with Nichols, simply could not move or breathe for the fear. But we had to keep moving, so we did. And yell at the others also. I dragged Tippett along with me, both of us still dripping. And I suppose it is the nature of battle, I didn't even feel how heavy he must have been. But soon he found his feet, and that part inside men that lets us do this at all. I want nothing more than to go home and never experience it again. It is dead quiet, aside from the sound of guns far away. No one talking or laughing as before. I think all the fellas must be having the same thoughts. What in God's name are we doing here? July 18. Healy, Vogt, and Sheehan from 1st Platoon came by. Sheehan's got a pal who's a cook, so he found himself some extra dog food that he decided to trade for smokes. So they settled down with me, Miller, and Frank Castellano, and Frank goes and gets Dietz, who doesn't smoke, who's the perfect man for this occasion. So anyhow, Frank comes back and says, "Now, Dietz, not a word here, pal." And then he goes to Sheehan and says, very officially, "I am Private First Class Dietz's attorney in this matter. Let me assure you that he is a fellow of substantial means." And he starts haggling for the chow using Dietz's smokes. Now, Frank did finish high school, unlike me and Dietz, but that's hardly college, is it? So I go, "Hey, Frank, how many times did you see young Mr. Lincoln?" And Miller elbows me and goes, "Buck, you mean young Mr. Castellana." Anyhow, by the time Frank gets to convincing Sheehan to take bank credit redeemable upon next resupply, so that we get the hash now and Sheehan gets the smokes later, Miller goes, "Objection, Your Honor," and stops it all, and then says, "Point of fact, we are going into action tomorrow and not getting resupplied before then, on Sheehan's behalf." Now, Miller wants the extra chow as much as any of us, but he likes a good joke more, doesn't he? And I'm good for a joke, too, so I say. More importantly here, Tech Corporal Castellano, is the fact that the United Bank of Dietz is facing serious risk of bankruptcy as a result of this impending action. And Dietz starts laughing and goes, I feel Jerry coming with the foreclosure papers as we speak. Miller looks very serious. Son, do those papers sound like an 88? And Sheehan goes, it does to me, Sarge. Frank looks at Dietz as disgusted as I ever saw him. You fucking moron, Dietz. The bank is the one who gives the foreclosure papers, not gets them. July 19th. Sitting around with First Sergeant Talley and Flynn and Vogel from 3rd Platoon, and of course me, Miller, and Carter and Glenn, and once he finishes with the briefing, five morons laid up with the clap, tell your men to use the frogskins God gave them, basically. Vogel breaks out a bottle of some sort of vermouth he found somewhere and says, what do you say, fellas? Anyway, get to talking, and Flynn's telling about how he heard a couple of his buck privates arguing with each other about who ought to ask Sergeant Flynn about how he got that scar. See, Flynn's got a stripe like a map of goddamn chili down the side of his face. Makes him look as mean as a made man. So Flynn gets his buddy, PFC Rossetti, who I don't know, to go spread a rumor that Flynn got it from when he was in prison for murder. But Rossetti, they're saying, horrified, convicts can't serve. And Rossetti goes, just be glad Uncle Sam's pointing him at the Krauts, and busts up laughing at their faces. Any boys too dumb or too young to believe that have no place being infantry on the front lines. Goddamn. Anyhow, so Carter goes, well, how did you get that scar, Arthur? Poor bastard gives the biggest sigh. Don't spread it around, but I got dropped as a little baby. And without a beat, Miller goes, well, we know that, Flynn, but how'd you get that scar? Anyhow, after we stop laughing, and seeing as Flynn didn't get his scar from a brawl after all, we get to talking about the biggest fight we ever been in. And hell, I got some of those. And so Miller goes to me and says, Buck, you boxed, didn't you? Sure did, pal. But the biggest fight I ever been in wasn't in a ring. I start up, and it makes me sick for home to think about it, but I have never had the chance to tell anybody what happened, on account of the fact that everybody back home knows about it already. So my friend Steve is a real fighter, I start off, and then yell for Castellano so he can get Plinsky, considering Plinsky's got probably 30 pounds on Steve, but they're the same height. So I got this friend Steve, a real son of a gun, type of fella who'll pick a fight with anybody he thinks might pick a fight with him. And he's about Plinsky's height, but skinny as a goddamn broomstick. So me and Steve go up to a jazz club in Harlem. Now, Steve don't like jazz, really, but he's a good sport and the best friend you'll ever have. So we're at the jazz club, and it's time to go, otherwise we're walking back to Brooklyn. Of course, Castellano's the only one from New York, so this doesn't mean much. Anyhow, we're not in our neighborhood. We're walking to the elevated, and we run across a couple of fellows who look like they stepped straight out of Lady Killer. And they know it, too. And I don't know what happened, but we're walking, and Steve laughs a bit, and sure enough, now we got two big fellas getting heated, saying, hey, punk, what are you laughing at? Well, if there's one thing Steve hates, it's being called a punk. So he stops short, and I think, oh, Lord, don't do it, because the dumb shit opens his mouth, all piss and vinegar, and says, I saw a funny joke walking. And he's fresh enough, they know exactly what he's doing. And so the second one, hell of a guy, bigger than me, well, he goes, oh, yeah? What kind of joke was it, then? Why don't you tell us the joke? This guy was trying to give us a chance to get the hell out of there. Well, I try and step in and go, come on, pal, let's get out of here. I hear a train coming. And I don't know if Steve's blood was up on account of he got stood up at the jazz club or something, but he plants his feet and looks up and down at the two guys and just says, I tell you, but I got a train to catch and I can't explain it three times. Cool as can be. And, well, it takes them maybe 15 seconds to figure out he's insulting them, so Steve was probably right. But after that, it's fist flying. Well, Steve's small, but he can scrap okay, and I'm no slouch myself. Castellano snorts on account of that time him and me had a little exhibition. Fucker's still angry I left out I was any good. How's a fella supposed to get any bragging done with Castellano around hogging it all? Anyway, we're in some trouble, and then we hear some whistles, and a few coppers are running towards us. And at the same time I see the train headed our way, so I grab Steve, yank him by the arm in the train just as the mobsters scram, and get the hell out of there. And here's the thing. We both got our noses busted, and a broken rib and busted knuckles, and for Steve, a tooth missing, all because Steve's got bad lungs and he had a little cough that they thought was a laugh, and he's too much of a little shit to correct the record. Anyhow, I haven't had a letter from Steve at all since June, and of course mail has been so slow that we haven't had any mail at all for 4 weeks, but telling stories about home does make a man miss it terribly, We are so very far away from home. July 23rd. Some fucking town that ends in O, I don't know. But most of the 2nd Battalion got pulled back, and today we had decent hot food for the first time since Africa. Not even A-rations, but stuff from here. Bread and pasta, and two fellas from Tennessee in the 16th actually butchered a fucking cow. They found it wandering around the village because the fences have all been cut, and it had a tag, but there are hardly any civilians here anyhow. And good God, I had seen enough fucking cows at Fort Howard, but at least did not have any guys trying to go after them with a knife and fork. And apparently they knew what they were doing, because 10 hours later we had fresh beef and steaks, and 2nd Lieutenant Kurlansky from 3rd Platoon found some sort of machine in the house he billeted himself in that he says will make hamburger. I don't want to know. Meat is supposed to come from the store wrapped in brown paper, and thank God I was not born in Tennessee but instead in Brooklyn like a civilized man. If they do make burgers, I will eat at least 5, seeing as we had a darts contest earlier, and some of the replacements bet their shares against me, and Miller and Glenn helped me hustle them. July 24th. It did make hamburgers, and we did not have the right bread or cheese, but goddamn were they fucking good. I gave 2 of mine to Sergeant Pike from 3rd Platoon, seeing as how he introduced me to Mary with the very red lips back in Africa, and any pal who talks you up to a dame who will put it in her mouth deserves a goddamn burger, all right. He said I owed him beers also, and I can't say I disagree. Maybe there's a Maria with very red lips around here somewhere, and I can help poor Pike out. July 27th. Walking through some of these little towns that we are capturing is not what I was expecting back before we shipped. I suppose it's that we saw all the newsreels from Africa, and maybe that is a little of what we thought we would see. Of course, it seems just as hot and dusty here, but these bleached stone houses and cobblestone paved roads, too skinny for our jeeps, are really nothing like I've seen before outside of pictures. Roads really are that narrow. Earl took over for the driver after much convincing, and was sure he could do it. Damn thing got stuck. White paint of the Army Star, totally scratched. Driver near in tears because of what the quartermaster will say. I watched the whole thing having a smoke. Harry says the strange part is the fact that many of the houses are empty or locked up or what have you. And I think he's right. A town with no people in it just seems flat wrong. I guess the civilians have tried to quit Sicily, knowing it's a battleground. And in any case, the Italians we have met are not great supporters of Hitler or Mussolini. But what else are they going to say to a pack of GIs? Some of these dames, though. July 31st. Private Rivera and Miller's squad hit today in legs and back by shrapnel. But Harry says, the doc says, he will survive. This has been The Night War, July 1943. Next week, Bucky Barnes and Able Company fight their way through Sicily and prepare to be the first American soldiers to set foot on mainland Europe since the Great War. If you'd like to explore behind-the-scenes extras, discuss this week's episode, or support our sponsors, visit us at thenightwar.com.